Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters.
I know you're weak. I know you've been broken down, fighting defeat. We know that we will rise above this pain. We know that we will stand up with strength. Everything's gonna be alright.
Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am Randy Fine, your talk show host. You know, I really love that song, A Time to Heal, because it tells us that everything's going to be all right. I also love it because it also says Time to Heal, which is the name of the show, basically, and it says Everything's Going to Be Fine, which is my name. So it all kind of works out together, but I love that show. Anyway, the reason I'm talking about that is because it's a song about hope. And in the midst of our struggles and our pain, often hope is really the only thing that we have to cling to. And our guest today is someone who can really explain to you how important hope is in our lives. Because there were times where she was hopeless, but she found hope, and now this is what her life is based on. Today, our guest is Nancy Verdin, who was once so depressed, she attempted suicide, but now she's going to share her hope with you. So let me introduce her to you, and we'll get started. Good morning, Nancy. How are you?
Hi, Randy. I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I think this is a really important show to do, so I appreciate you being on. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your story? We'll start that way.
Okay. Well, I guess I should introduce myself first in a way. I have become, after a lifetime of not sure what I was supposed to do or who I was supposed to be, I have become a mental health and recovery advocate. And so now I'm going around and talking about this topic, telling my story and talking about how hope is very, very reachable for everyone and explaining what it is that I have found hope in and how I got there, more importantly, because I think many times we talk about hope, but we don't talk about how to get there. And that's my main point, I guess, is to talk about how from point zero, where there isn't any hope, I actually grew to where there's plenty. And so that's kind of how I start out.
Right. And I, you know, normally I read your credentials, and I'm sorry I didn't read that, but I'm glad that you did cover that. So, that's very important that you're a mental health and recovery advocate and founder of Always the Fight Ministries, as well as an author. So now... Yes. Now that we've established that, that's very important. So tell us a little bit about where you've come from, you know, not where you were, your state of mind, state of being.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I believe I spent a lifetime believing I was unlovable, that I was never good enough. I had reason to believe that I was rejected and neglected, etc. And I took the evidence of all the negative and embraced it. And all the evidence for the positive, I set aside, or I questioned it, or I denied it. So while I had gifts and talents and hopes and dreams, I set those aside and said, well, those are not worth anything because I'm not worth anything. And the evidence that came by, and there's always plenty, we will always find people in our lives who don't think we're much. So since I found those people and hung on to their words and their opinions, that is how I believe about myself. That's how I reinforced, I should say, the core beliefs I already had, that I wasn't worth anything. So I spent my lifetime doing that for the most part. I'm 55 years old now, just so people can get a time frame. And I experienced several major depressive episodes throughout my life, many of which took me to the brink of suicide. But when I was 49 years old, I actually attempted suicide with every intention of dying. And because I did not, I found myself in the hospital being very, very surprised that I was still here. I can't really explain that, except that it was almost like a little bit of a shock. And I was walking around the hospital hallway there in the behavioral health ward and just kind of amazed, like, why am I still here? Why am I still answering these questions that I've answered before? Like, what can you do to feel better? What can you do to, what are you going to do to try and get yourself out of this? And as therapists, et cetera, were trying to push me into the more healthy kind of thinking. My question was, why am I doing this again? I don't want to be here. And so a few days after the first suicide attempt, I attempted again in the hospital. It was a long healing process, not so much physically. That only took a few weeks, but the healing mentally took a long time. So that was when I was 49, and I had one therapist tell me I was actually progressing very fast, in his opinion, because I really did put the elbow grease in. When they told me how to start changing how I think and stuff, I would actually start practicing that, and that is something I'd like to talk more about. But it took me a while to not be suicidal. I think it took over 16 months, actually. And it was a year and however many, 4 months, I guess, after the original attempt that I was able to thank the psychologist who saved my life and mean it. So I try to tell people that the healing from these things is not quick. We try to tell people to snap out of it or get their act together, and sometimes it's a very long process. And after I decided not to think about suicide so much anymore, it still has taken me quite some time to learn to enjoy life.
Now, as you heard in the intro, I work with people who are victims and survivors of narcissistic abuse. And
correct.
The key thing with narcissistic abuse is that it deprives you or takes away your self-love, self-esteem, self-validation, all those
right.
kind of things. And if you have never had it and you have been told all these other things in your life, especially from the beginning of your life, it's very, very hard to find your way. Life becomes a huge uphill climb.
Yes.
And I can understand where the hopelessness can come in. I'm always amazed at those who reach out to me because their stories are always very, very disturbing, very upsetting. And I think to myself, what kind of power the human spirit is absolutely capable of? That they're still standing. Generally, they are in their 40s and 50s, and they're still standing and trying to figure this out. So I guess hope is another word for the power of the human spirit. Would you say?
You know, I would say there's a lot of strength in that opinion. I have a serious, I mean, I have a high respect for people who seem to have, I guess to use the colloquial term, it's kind of a little bit of a stigma term as well, is people who pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But I would also like to suggest that nobody really does it on their own. there's people around us. I have a little podcast show of my own, and I was just interviewing a woman yesterday who has not looked into medications or therapy for herself very much, but she has found herself surrounded by people who bring in wisdom and insight at the time that she needs it. And none of us are really pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. So I guess I want to qualify my answer a bit on the human spirit. I think the human spirit is very much dependent on other human spirits and also on God. And so we have this power not so much in ourselves, I don't believe, as much as we can build on the strength that is offered to us from other sources. That's what I believe. So on the inside of me, I spent 49 years trying to live life a certain way. And it wasn't until my eyes and ears were opened to another way that I was able to really get any strength that I have girded up to move forward. But all the while, I have to say that as a Christian, I give credit to my Lord for the strength that I have inwardly. But even if you don't see that as an asset, people who don't believe or whatever, I still think that from the outside is where a lot of our strength comes. But I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to undermine anybody's idea of strength, because we have to
right.
have strength in order to reach for help and,
right.
and take
well,
what
it
is
being
offered.
You know, it comes from a spiritual perspective. And I come from a spiritual perspective as well, not a religious one, but just a spiritual perspective in that I know that there are unseen helpers that are with me at all times, that I didn't come here alone, because this life journey is very difficult. And I know that I have support from the spirit world, whatever we want to call that. And that is really what gave me great hope. Some people just aren't ready to grasp that. Can we talk about hope without talking about God or the spirit world? I mean, where else do we
yes.
get hope from? Yeah,
absolutely. I don't believe they are mutually exclusive. Like if you don't have faith in Christ, then therefore you have no way of managing your life. I don't mean that. It goes much deeper than that, but we're not here necessarily to talk about my faith. What I want to point out, and what is so important, is that when we're at the very bottom and we've really lost ourselves, sometimes we just need somebody to come along and say, there's another way, there's an option. Because at the very, very bottom, if you're at that place where there are no options but death, you really need another option presented to you. And for me, that was through a therapist. Like I said, the woman I interviewed yesterday came through friends and family. But one of the first things that was offered to me was the idea that maybe my life mattered. And from everything I said about not feeling worthwhile and not feeling lovable and everything, the idea that my life might be worth something was quite a surprise. Again, I go back to my faith in the sense that one of my personal motives was to honor is to honor God. So whatever motive somebody has for staying alive, it's important. I know that some people find that motive in their family. Some people find it in their work. Some people find it in their pet, you know, like, oh, so-and-so needs me, or my pet needs me, I can't go now. And any of those motives that keep us alive are fine, and they're very, very important. So with somebody telling me that my life could actually be worthwhile, I started to think along the lines of, oh, okay, maybe I can do good deeds, you know, maybe God can use me to help other people. And it wasn't enough to take away suicidal thoughts. It wasn't enough to take away the desire to die, but it was enough to keep me alive so that that little spark, that tiny little spark of maybe life has something different for me, was enough to keep me going. It's very, very important that whoever is at that point of, I want to die and there's no other option but death, to have something to hang on to. I remember calling a crisis line once, and she said, you have to have something emotional in the future to hang on to. She said, you sound very logical and analytical, but logic will fail you. And she was absolutely right, because we're not going to be able to reason away all the things that interfere with our mental health. What we have to have is something important to latch onto that's in the future that we know that we want. And I had people suggest things to me like, well, you know, this could happen or this could happen. You could do this with your life or whatever. And somebody suggested grandchildren and that kind of thing in the future. And I have to admit that for me personally, none of those things were enough. They were important, and they raised my eyebrows a little bit. But they weren't enough because I had convinced myself that anything I was here for, I wasn't good enough to do. So for me, my focus became more of an eternal one. But at the same time, it was just that spark that there could be a reason for being here, that my life could actually matter, was the option that was handed to me. And it was enough. It was enough to keep me going for quite some time. As I learned things that I needed to know, you know, about my thinking patterns and challenging those core beliefs and facing situations that I was in with truth instead of denial, as I went through all of those processes, it was the idea that maybe my life could matter that was really, you know, kind of the light in front of me.
Right. You know, and you said, you know, that it was, well, you just said it, that the idea, the spark, the little teeny spark that your life could matter, and that things could, that there was something to look forward to in the future, is what enough that helped you to hang on. So nowhere and at no time in your life did anybody ever tell you your life mattered?
Well, I can't say that they never did, but I wasn't hearing it. Okay. I had my core beliefs, okay? I had learned as a very young child that women are worth what men say they are worth. Mm-hmm. And so I had the very powerful desire for men to tell me I was worth something. And okay. It overrode a lot of other reasonable thinking. So when somebody would come along and say, you know, your value is great and you mean something to me, or something that you did or said mattered to me, or I'm glad you're alive. I actually had one person say that to me, which I'll never forget because it's a powerful statement. But when that person was not able to stay in my life for whatever reason, you know, they were just passing through or anything, I would find the evidence. I would find the evidence so readily that they, A, didn't mean it, or B, they didn't really know me. C, they meant it for a minute, but now they found out who I really am and they're gone. You know, that's the evidence I would look at, instead of the fact that I actually did matter to that person. That I would deny.
Right. Right. Got it. You say that hope begins to appear when we decide to believe for it. And that might be a typo. We decide to believe for it. Okay.
Can you explain that? Yeah. Well, I think that there are quite a few people in your audience and in the world at large who can absolutely relate to the idea of having no hope at all, zero. Most of us can relate to having hopeless feelings, and some of them are very strong. But there are those of us who can relate to having none. And when I say none, I mean there is no option but death, because there's nothing else to live for. When you're at that place, or even when your hopeless feelings are very, very strong and not zero yet, having the idea that these other people, in my life they were professionals. I had doctors and therapists looking at me and telling me there was hope. I didn't believe them. From my point of view, there wasn't any. But there was this person telling me there was. And so I would look at them, and because they were professionals and they had this experience and they had been experienced for a long time, I thought, well, okay, so I'm sitting here with my little life telling you there's no hope. You're sitting there with the experience of years and years and years of working with people like me, and you're telling me that there is. So maybe I can believe that you believe there's hope. And that's what I mean by believing for it. Like there's, I don't see it, I don't feel it, I don't have it, but I can believe that maybe you have it, and maybe I could get a little piece of that someday. Maybe, I don't know.
Right.
So believing for it, that to me was the very, very vital beginning to healing. Yes, absolutely.
Interesting. You know, the thing that that I personally have learned throughout life, and with the benefit of hindsight, is that tomorrow can look so much different than today, no matter what the situation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If I would have judged my life from the point of view that I had between my 20s and 30s, or between 20 and 30, I would say, and maybe even earlier than that, I would have really thought this was going nowhere. So I think it's important for all of us to know that even though there is nothing today, something can come tomorrow. And that
that's
a bit of hope that really kept me going. Now I can look back and I can see how much things change in life. And no matter, we don't have to do anything for life to change.
That's true.
You know, it just does.
Yes.
It just evolves
yes.
and changes. People come in our life. They say things. All of a sudden, we get a phone call. We get an experience. We run into somebody. We just don't know how things are going to change in our life. So there is always hope. But when you get to the point where you feel totally hopeless, is that always coming from a depressive illness of sorts, or can it be just a lifetime of being crushed over and over and over again?
I believe it's probably both, but I'm not a scientist. What I do understand is that we have the propensity towards a certain mental illness, and in my case, it's major depression. But I don't think that major depression caused hopelessness. I think it caused me to struggle, but hopelessness was built upon by what you called the lifetime of being crushed. So I would call it twofold, but I don't want to get too technical, I guess, because I feel like that might sound confusing. People can grasp that and understand what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I grew up in a home that was lacking in love. And there was violence involved, and there was what is known as parental alienation involved, where one parent mm-hmm. is teaching you to hate the other. And mm-hmm. there were things involved that were very unhealthy, and emotional abandonment, that kind of thing. So as I grew up through life, I had a developed idea of where I fit in this world, and it was an unhealthy idea. And I married, and my marriage perpetuated that idea. And as I went through life, I accomplished good things. I had friendships. They tended to be temporary, but I had friendships. I had things that I could probably look back on and say, at least I did something right. But I never really felt on top of my game. I never believed that there wasn't something next that was going to be better than this last moment. So, for instance, I ran a community thing for children for quite a few years, and they loved it. Parents loved it. For the most part, it was successful at what I was trying to do. But every single night that I would come home from working with those kids, I beat myself like torture mentally. I would just tell myself that, oh, you did this wrong, you did that wrong, you did this wrong, you did that wrong, and this is why you were stupid today. And this is why you don't matter today. You should just quit trying. And these thoughts would just go through my head, and I would pummel myself with them. And I would try to fight them with, no, this is what happened, and you just keep going. This is what you're supposed to do with your life. You just keep moving. But it was exhausting. And unfortunately, that's not a one-time or limited experience to just working with those kids. That was almost every area of my life, all the time.
So I can so relate to that. Nancy, I can so relate to that.
For decades?
Right.
Oh,
that's exactly how I felt.
That's
how I felt, too. I understand that.
And if that's what you're telling yourself for years and years, and regardless of the evidence otherwise, if that's what you're believing, you're going to become hopeless. You know, you may have major depression, but that's going to feed it for sure. So, you know, what hope is there when you believe that everything that you do is resulting in bad, or that you're hurting people all the time or without meaning to, or anything, you know? That negative self-talk is poison.
It is. You're absolutely right. And everybody does it, but people that have histories like yours and mine and many of my listeners, that is the mantra. The only talk we know is negative self-talk.
Yeah.
It's important, right? It's important to, you know, shows like this are so important because it really wakes us up to the fact, you know. The only way to really change that is to be cognizant of it and change it. There is no magic pill. It's just a matter of saying, I recognize that thought isn't working for me. I need to change that, you know?
I need
right?
to change it.
Right.
And that exactly. And that right there is where I like to pick up with people, because we are told to change things and we're not told how. So I would like to share with you one way that I started to change negative self-talk.
Great.
I started to play a little game with myself. So, for instance, I recall walking across the parking lot on my way to my apartment one day, and I was thinking, oh, you're so stupid. You just did it again. Why are you always so stupid? And I changed what I made a purposeful game out of it, that I would take the first letter of what I was about to call myself and turn it into another word. So
cool.
The obvious
good.
One to stupid would be smart, okay? So I'm walking across the parking lot, and I go, you're so smart. And I hated doing it because I didn't believe it, okay?
Right.
And then I would continue to do that, and I remember one time reaching up into the closet. I think I was trying to put something on a shelf, and it fell. And my first response was, it figures. You know, like, of course it's dumb. I'm dumb. I can't do anything right, of course. And I thought, wait a minute. By this time, I'd been taught or was in the process of learning to challenge evidence. And so I thought, wait a minute. How many times have you put things on this shelf that haven't fallen? Look at how many things are on this shelf, you know. And so I went, well, no, it doesn't just figure. It was a one-time thing, and it's kind of funny. And so I laughed. That kind of change was a process, but it was proactive, and it took work and effort. And after a while, those automatic thoughts went away, Randy. They went away.
I don't
tell myself I'm stupid anymore. If I do, which is rare, I recognize it and go, well, you can just go away. You know, that's not me anymore. But the automatic thinking that I had lived with all of my life was disintegrating, and it was due to practice, actual practice. And so that's what I like to tell people, you know, that's one way, and there are many other ways.
And if you don't mind, I'm going to share that trick with my clients, because I think that's a really, really cute. I like it. I kind of call it, the Eeyore complex for, you know, everybody who knows Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, woe is me. Life is never going to get better. The clouds are here again, you know.
I used to call my husband Eeyore all the time because he, so much would go right in his life, and he would focus on the one thing that would go wrong. You know, I'm like, oh, there you go with the Eeyore complex again. But I love that. I love what you do. I think that's excellent, an excellent technique.
Well, it works for me. And I still do it when I have a bad day or a reason, you know, maybe the evidence is actually glaring at me that I did something not perfect. Okay. I'll still look at my responses and challenge them. And that's become a habit. It's automatic. I'm no longer struggling to do that. It's just who I am now.
Right.
So that's the kind of hope I like to throw out to people, because we can sit there and say, oh, this is me. This is, I don't have any hope. This is the way it's always been. And I want to throw out that option that was thrown to me. Maybe your life can matter. Maybe there really is hope. You still see it right now. And here are some steps you can take to maybe find it. And that's what I like to throw out.
Right. Often what goes on in our head is not relevant to our current life.
That's true.
You know, it really isn't. And so we really do have to reevaluate, you know, this negative self-talk and this, you know, this dialogue that's constantly playing and playing and playing in our heads. And the only way to stop it is to stop it, to look at it and go, wait a minute. I'm going to challenge you, and I just love the way you do that. So we're 30 minutes into the hour, and I want to give you an opportunity to, you know, maybe talk about something that you feel is really important that maybe we haven't covered yet. Is there something you think is important to share?
Wow. You're going to limit me to one?
Well, I'm going to give you, let's see, it's 11:32, and we have till about 11:40, so you have 8 minutes. Go.
8 minutes to wrap up life, in it, right?
Right, 8 minutes.
Yeah,
right.
I would have to say that believing that there's more is an effort. I guess what I want to tell people is that when we're supporting someone who is severely depressed and we're trying to tell them that what they ought to do and what they're not doing and what they're missing because they're not doing, we're basically pointing the finger and telling them that everything they believe about themselves already is true.
Wow.
What we need to offer to people is, I'm glad you're alive. You matter to me. I know you're struggling right now. I wish you weren't struggling. This is hard for all of us. But I'm here with you, and we're going to get through this. And those kinds of words are the kinds that build people up. And if we could focus on using words that build people up, rather than trying to control the situation or control the other person, we're going to find that our support is actually much more effective. And when we really love someone, and we do love people who are depressed, we just can't get what they're doing and what they're going through, and sometimes it drives us a little frustrated, but we really do love them. We have to think past what it is that we're seeing. Again, it's almost like challenging the evidence again. Okay, what do you see? You see that person laying in bed, and they're not going to work, and they're not taking care of basic needs, and wow, that's nasty. Okay, so get up. Come on. Take care of basic needs. Come on. Do this with me. Do that. And go to work already. And then we get angry sometimes. But real love steps back and says, what else do you see? What evidence is there? Okay, evidence is that she or he is telling me they can't get out of bed. Will I believe them? Will I take the time to really listen? When they say that they can't find any reason to keep going, do I hear that, or am I trying to interpret it in my way? So we need to be more supportive in the sense that we are telling people that they matter, A, they, you matter to me, you matter a whole lot, that their life matters, and that regardless of what they can see in the moment, there's more. and that you want them to hang in there. Clearly, if someone is suicidal and there's a plan and an intent and they're talking about suicide, especially in the moment, we aren't supposed to just pretend that's not happening either. We need to look at that evidence and take it seriously. And we need to get that person to help, and sometimes immediately.
Right.
But we have this great plan in our heads. I think, Randy, we all like to just formulate what we see into the things that make us comfortable. And so, you know, I don't like the fact that you're so depressed, so I'm going to try and fix it. Or I don't like the fact that you're talking suicide, so I'm going to pretend you're not. And these things are not helpful and, in fact, could possibly be dangerous. I think that's one thing I want to encourage those who have loved ones who are severely depressed to do, and just, you know, just be there and seek professional help for yourself if you need to, not in the sense maybe that you need traditional therapy, but in the sense that you can ask a professional how to help your friend, how to help your loved one. And I like to tell people, don't be afraid to look at the specialists. You know, they're there for a reason. They have the education and the degrees that we don't have. And sometimes we want to go to the GP just because it's easier, but maybe that person wasn't trained in mental health issues, and we need to go to the specialist. So not to be afraid to do that. I covered more than one. Is that allowed?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. what you're saying is to validate people's experiences. Say, I see you. I hear what you're saying. I understand that you're feeling that way. You don't have to understand why.
No,
but validation is so important, especially when you have grown up in a childhood where you've never gotten validated for anything good at all.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Right. Right.
Exactly
so,
right. If your situation has been that you've not been given the love that you need, and you might look back. I've met people who look back and go, but I don't understand. I had the perfect mom and dad. Well, that might be true. You might have been wrapped up in love, but maybe it wasn't exactly everything that you needed. And I'm not a therapist, so I'm not even going to go any deeper than that. What I'm just going to say is that we have to look at what's really going on. Let's look at the truth. Let's not live in this little fantasy world anymore that you know, oh, I'm not really depressed. I need to pull myself up out of the bootstraps. I'm a bad person because I can't get my act together or et cetera.
Right.
Let's get out of that. And as a support, let's get out of this idea that we can somehow fix and change the situation. Let's look at the truth. Let's look at the truth. Depression is nasty, and it saps hope out of people, and people have a number of reasons to feel hopeless. We can look at any number of histories and reasons why people will feel hopeless, and they're there, and they're I don't even think we can count them. We can look at the fact that this person is really kind of stuck now in this dysfunctional depression and respect that for what it is.
Exactly.
So let's not, you know, trying to revamp things in our heads into what we wish they were, but let's look
right.
at the truth. And when
right.
everybody is willing to do that, then we see progress and we see hope and we see help and lives change and relationships change and et cetera, et cetera.
Right. You know, in my I have a book that's with a literary agent right now. We're looking for a publisher, but I think it's the last chapter in the book is for the people who are dealing with the victims and survivors, because exactly what you just said, for the exact reasons, they have to know how to deal with these people because they have been beaten down for so many years. And for somebody to say, get over it, is just insult to injury. You know, why can't you get over it? Get up, like you said, all those kind of things. Get up and start living again. Well,
yeah.
That is just more oppression, and that makes
yeah.
it even worse. So I dedicated a whole chapter to, you know, the people who love those who are going through this. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. I think it's very, very important. It's important who we expose ourselves to. The other thing is, though, you talked about getting professional help, and sometimes the professional help that we get is not necessarily the right help. And
oh, I've been there.
Yes. And everyone that comes to me has been has had counseling and spent years of counseling or been from one to the other, and they say, I spent lots of money, I got nowhere, and I feel worse. Why is that? Sometimes the approach of a counselor is not the one that you need, and if that happens, then you need to find a different kind of approach. But don't give up. Don't give up.
That's
really
right.
Important.
That's right, Andy. And I learned something in this process, too, that I'd had counselors before who, in all seriousness, shouldn't be in the profession. And when I found good counselors, they told me that I was allowed to interview people, that I could go to the therapist, call the office, whatever, and find out, you know, I can look them up and look at their experience and their license and everything and figure out first. But when you're in the depths of depression, that's near impossible. So that's something else that a support person can do, do the research and find a therapist, not just anybody that hung out their shingle, but somebody who has experience and license and a positive reputation. And then that's something we can do for ourselves as well before we get too down. We can have that information at hand. You know, we can be proactive and prepare.
Right.
So.
Exactly. And just we really are running out of time, but I want to challenge the word license because a license does not always guarantee that you're going to get help. The person's experience, life experience, how they can apply it to you is generally more important. And I say that because I'm not a licensed therapist, and yet I help hundreds and thousands of people. And they get help for the first time ever because I've lived what they've lived. So sometimes it's not the license and we get hung up on that. So I just had to point that out. But everything that you've said today is absolutely wonderful. You know, really positive, good stuff that we all need to hear. And especially the listeners that particularly tune into my show because they are looking for that thread of hope often. To hang on to. Thank you so much for coming on the show and bringing your story and your experience. And how do people contact you?
Well, you can contact me by going to my website first, and that is simply nancyverdon.com. Sometimes people stumble over how to spell my name, so I added a second domain name that's a lot easier. It's just alwaysthefight.com. And that's a lot easier to remember, I think. So you go to alwaysthefight.com, and you're going to find me, and I'm in the process of revamping my website, but you can also find my email there and follow and, you know, whatever else you want to do. You can see my podcasts and my books and et cetera there.
Perfect, perfect. So either Nancy Verdon, VIRDEN.com, or alwaysthefight.com.
Yes.
Thanks again. I have to say goodbye or we're going to get cut off. But it's really been a wonderful conversation and I've enjoyed you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Okay. Bye-bye. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye.
Bye. Well, thanks for tuning in. We are over. Thanks for tuning in and listening to A Fine Time for Healing. This is Talk Radio show host, author, life issues counselor, Randy Fine, signing off until next time. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's programming. To learn more about Randy Fine, read her articles, or to make a counseling appointment with her, please visit randygfine.com. That's RANDIGFINE.com. Or visit her on Facebook at Randy G. Fine.